Welcome to the first episode of Business Law Focus, your go-to source for breaking legal news that matters for businesses, entrepreneurs, the C-suite, and professionals. I'm your host, Evan Peckworth, editor of Business Day Law and Tax, and today we're discussing an important recent ruling by the Constitutional Court. This ruling provides much-needed clarity on the powers of a court to strike down or refuse a contract. One glance at the news today shows how important a topic this is. It's a pleasure to welcome Michael Katz, chairperson of ENS Africa and, of course, of the Katz Commission fame, which played such an integral role in reforming SA's tax system following the birth of democracy in 1994. He's joined by ENS Africa executives Professor Dale Hutchinson and Julius Oosthuizen. Thanks for joining us, gentlemen, for the first in a series of Business Day Law and Tax podcasts. Now, you've done some really interesting analysis of the recent Oregon Trust or Bideker contractual ruling by the Constitutional Court. Is it fair to say it is now harder for someone to get out of a contract because it is not fair or unreasonable or unduly harsh? There has, of course, been a lot of uncertainty and controversy over this in the past, giving the C-suite grey hairs.
I think the judgment, the virtue of the judgment to me is twofold. It does now place in a proper perspective the role of public policy in contracts, and secondly, it eliminates the so to say uncertainty of an apparent inconsistency between the Constitutional Court and the Supreme Court of Appeal. And that perceived division was giving rise to problems. And I think now, from the point of view of the practitioner, it does eliminate that concern. A little later in this discussion, Evan, I'm going to come back to the extent to which uncertainty still exists, not from the point of view of what the law is, but how to apply it, because at the end of the day, it is subjective for the court. So we can deal with the principles, but towards the end of this discussion, I want to revert to the uncertainty in applying the law.
Brilliant. Thanks, Michael. The Bank of Lisbon case back in 1988 effectively ruled out bad faith, known as exceptio doli, as a defense for being too broad, right? So how is this really different?
Well, if I can answer that, the old exceptio doli was like a very technical defense from Roman law, and its status in our law had always been uncertain. So when the court threw out that decision, that remedy in our law, the thought was at the time that it was throwing out all concern for fairness in contract. But in fact, it was barely 6 months later, in the case of Sasson versus Bucus, that the same court, with different judges sitting, said that to strike down an agreement as being unconscionable, and said that public policy is concerned not only with sanctity of contract, but with what they described as simple justice between man and man. And that set off a long debate thereafter about the role of fairness and good faith in our law of contract.
Thanks, Dale. I think that sums it up very well. But this case was specific to a lease with a BEE entity, right? Would it still have had force for other contracts? Or still have force for other contracts?
Yes, undoubtedly. It lays down a general approach to contract, and it's not specific to lease in any way. It is tackling head-on this question, which has vexed our law for a long time, is what precisely is the role of these notions of these open-ended values of good faith, fairness, justice, reasonableness, all summed up these days as Ubuntu in our law of contract.
Now, one look at the news shows billions of rand in corrupt deals surfacing. Yet they were all based on contracts initially between two contracting parties in apparent subject agreement with each other. So does this decision help in having these contracts overturned as invalid? And for instance, I'm referring to those in the private sector, specifically between the likes of, say, a Trillion and other private companies, for instance.
I would say this decision was concerned primarily with fairness as one aspect of public policy. It has always been the law that a contract that is tainted with fraud or is in any other way contrary to public policy will be struck down or will not be enforced. And there's no doubt about it that a contract which is tainted with corruption is contrary to public policy and is liable to be set aside by the court.
And Julius, just your sense, the level of corruption in contracts at the moment, do you also get a view that the public policy element is becoming far more prominent now when it comes to closing those down, or striking down those contracts, or clauses anyway?
So even I think if we go back to the logic of the judgment and saying that there is a two-step test which essentially must be applied, which is firstly to look at whether the provisions of the contract itself are objectionable to such an extent that they should simply not be enforced, and then secondly, if you pass that test, whether the enforcement of the provision is in fact unreasonable or contrary to public policy in the circumstances. My sense would be that if you have concluded a commercial contract which on the face of it seems regular, it would be the second part of the test that would be potentially more applicable. So in other words, where one would say, look, now that we may have agreed this contract initially and it was all signed in good faith, but circumstances have subsequently shown that it is in fact tainted by corruption, and therefore for the counterparty in those circumstances to enforce it could well be so unconscionable that it is contrary to public policy. I think there could certainly be scope for that argument, and one would hope to see that, yes.
If I may just intercede here, I think with respect, the thrust of this judgment isn't really in the context of corruption. And I think we must just make that point clear. Where there is corruption, fraud, illegality, then the law is very easy to set it aside. I think this judgment, as Dale and Julius have said, deals with two issues. One, whether the clause was unfair, judged against public policy, then it won't be upheld. But even if it is upheld, if the circumstances in which it is sought to be enforced would be against public policy, then it won't be enforced. But I don't think that the thrust of this judgment should be seen in the context of the fight against corruption. There, I think, in the public sector, you'll have breach of the provisions of the Constitution, many other provisions to have it set aside, and also in the private sector, contracts which are tainted by fraud or illegality won't be enforced, won't be upheld. But I don't think this judgment should be seen as a fight, as a weapon in the fight against corruption.
Mm. There was also a little bit of a twist in this particular judgment, which was specific relating to a BEE entity or party which was not able to pay the lease. And, you know, basically, it didn't really give reasons for its non-compliance, right? If it had given reasons for non-compliance, do you think that would have changed the outcome?
Well,
quite possibly. I mean, but there would have to be quite good reasons for failing to comply with a valid term in the contract. For example, in the Barkhuizen case, which concerned a time limitation clause in a short-term insurance contract. You had to bring your claim within 90 days, and the guy had failed to do that. The court then toyed with the idea of impossibility. I mean, if the evidence showed that he'd been lying in a coma in hospital, then quite obviously that would be a very good reason for not enforcing the term of the contract. But that's an extreme example, of course. Your question raises a far more difficult issue with BEE and the transformation of the economy, the fact that the person trying to get out of the contract, or the fact that accepting the termination of the contract is going to lead to the failure of an important BEE initiative. Is that sufficient public policy factor to excuse the non-compliance of the contract? And the majority judgment says, look, you know, if you do that, effectively you're having two different laws here, one for BEE-type transactions and one for ordinary transactions. And that would be counterproductive to the goals of the National Empowerment Fund, because you would find that people would be reluctant to contract with parties in that sort of situation. The other judges thought somewhat differently, but that I think is a very important consideration.
Just to add to that, it's quite interesting. There were two sides to the BEE coin. Now, clearly, if there was reasons, forget about the BEE side, for the non-exercise of the option, and that could have changed the fairness. And the proportionality test, was the consequence so great, allowing for the cancellation or the non-renewal, but taking aside ordinary commercial considerations that wouldn't exist in a non-BE, and just concentrating on the BE element, there the court said that's two-dimensional. If you allow it to be set up simply because the other contracting party is BEE, you may be doing a great disservice to the BEE initiative, because many people will then be reluctant to enter into contracts of BEE counterparties. So the majority judgment really emphasized that part of it.
If I may just add to that as well, I think it actually points to another, perhaps a more technical aspect, but which is very important, I think, to remember, which is that the court was also careful to emphasize that the principle of sanctity of contract still remains a cornerstone and fundamentally important, even though it is not the only issue within public policy. But so here, one is saying, look, yes, even though there might have been particular circumstances and there was the BEE flavor to the transaction, that in and of itself was certainly not enough to disturb that principle. So there was quite a strong emphasis again on saying, look, we have to still be able to rely in public discourse on our contracts being enforced, unless there is such a compelling reason that should not be the case, you know.
Just to close out the BEE component, is there a sense that if you're now sitting as an executive, you're getting into a BEE contract, is there a case that you need to be a little bit more pertinent in how you deal with certain of the clauses? Could they be perceived to be too harsh in the circumstances when it comes to potential non-performance or termination down the line?
You know, it's not just BEE as such, but what is increasingly important in contract law, not only in our law but around the world, is when there is inequality between the parties. If you're dealing with someone who is
in a business sense, relatively unsophisticated, and you are in a far more powerful position where you can exercise contractual power over the other party. Courts around the world are wary of that situation. In fact, there is, since Biedeker case, there's just been a case decided in Canada by the Supreme Court of Appeal where they've developed their doctrine of unconscionability. One of the judges preferred to use public policy the way our court has gone, but the majority spoke about unconscionability, and they made it quite clear there that it's, you know, when you get in it, unequal big bargaining power, and the one person imposes unreasonable terms on the other, that the court might refuse to enforce it.
The Consumer Protection Act, for instance, I'm looking at the impact of this judgment potentially on consumers. A lot of concerns over consumer rights. And when I look at, for instance, Section 40 of the CPA, it includes quite broad values. The one that I picked up was unfair tactics, where you can actually have a case, you know, in favor of a consumer when unfair tactics were used. It doesn't seem to me to fit well with this judgment, right?
If I could answer that again, I think you've got to draw a distinction these days between consumer contracts and commercial contracts. And the CPA is geared for commercial, for consumer contracts. And they have there a provision that the consumer is entitled to terms in the contract that are fair, just, and reasonable. And they have a fairly circular definition in the Act itself of when a term is unfair, they say, when it's inequitable or when it's totally one-sided. But there's a very helpful set of guidelines in the regulations about terms that are assumed until the contrary is shown to be unfair and unreasonable. So there's a whole area of law developing there, specifically in consumer contracts, and I think it is generally accepted that you want sanctity of contract to apply far more strictly to commercial contracts than to consumer contracts because of this element of inequality that I mentioned earlier.
Fabulous. That explains it wonderfully. Michael, in conclusion, over to you to give us a sum of, and also feel free, Julius and Dale, to jump in to add to what Michael's about to say about the actual implications and certain practical aspects.
So, Evan, I think with respect, as has been emphasized in this discussion, the principles have been, I think, now enunciated with greater certainty. So we know where public policy fits in, fairness, sanctity of contract, inequality of bargaining powers. I think all those principles have been now put to bed. But the difficulty arises in applying it. And why do I say that? Because at the end of the day, the application of these principles in any contested case before the court is going to be dependent on the subjective assessment of them by the bench. And even in the Biedeker case, we saw 7-2, seven judges taking the same principles, applied it one way, and two judges, very cogent reasoning, applied it another way. So what do we as practitioners now do? And it arises in two stages. Stage one is in drafting contracts, sitting with clients. How do we evaluate whether a particular clause is going to be upheld or not? So that's the first time that the practical application of a court arises. Now, I think on this, we're starting to set up guidelines in our firm. There are some clauses that are clearly out. There are some clauses that are going to clearly be in. So there's going to be the middle grey area. And there we would tell clients, in this grey area, try and move towards the clearly good. So that's in the drafting of contracts. Now, this problem of subjectivity is also going to arise at the time of an enforcement of a contract. And once again, we are going to say to clients, these are principles where even though the clause will be upheld, the enforcement of it in these circumstances is going to be problematic. And also, you are, to an extent, guessing what the subjective view of judges is. So what I think is going to happen from now on, we as a firm, and I suppose our peers in that, will start building up studies of this is what in these cases actuated a court to go in this direction. And I think to try and mitigate the uncertainty of application, we're going to start doing that.
So even if I could add to that, and this obviously there would be a myriad, I think, of potential scenarios, you know, but maybe to give some sort of practical flesh to that, one of the things that one could say is that wherever a contract allows for something to be approved by a party in its discretion, one may want to say there, look, be very careful here in terms of showing that you've done so reasonably, you know, which you often see in contracts as well. So sort of view it as saying, if I exercise a discretion, I do so reasonably. Or, for example, if you're going to rely on a non-variation clause, then think about whether you have, in fact, in your discussions with your counterparty, you know, whether you've actually led them on to say, look, well, it's actually okay, and we agree to this variation of the agreement, or you need not pay us next week, you know, that type of thing. And those are some of the examples where one could think, look, this is going to be more difficult, and therefore make sure you keep your house in order. One may even go a step further and say, in a scenario like this one, you know, we never saw the reasons of the franchisees for not exercising their rights in time. But maybe if the counterparty wanted to be 100% certain, it should actually have reminded the lessees beforehand, have said, look, your period for issuing the notice is coming up. What are you going to do? You know, so again, we didn't get the chance to test that here, but those would certainly be the kind of things that one would, I think, have to look at from a practical perspective.
And two others, Evan, you would look at are the remedies that a party has contracted for disproportionate to the wrong. In other words, is someone who was a day late on exercising an option, is the court going to enforce that, however much the contract itself may have allowed? Okay. Another example, anything that is in the direction of self-help that ousts the court. If you do this, I can determine what's going to happen. I can sell you out. So I think principles of fairness are going to distill, and proportionality, I think, is going to be a big issue.
Yes, if I could come in, I would agree with that. You know, although this judgment reinforces the importance of sanctity of contract in our law, there's no doubt about it now that there's a much greater focus on the need for parties to act fairly and reasonably as an aspect of public policy. Previously, there was a strong view that public policy was concerned with general harm to the general public rather than to fairness as between the parties to the contract themselves. That is clearly no longer tenable. It has been thrown out by this judgment, and although inevitably when you allow open-ended concepts like fairness and reasonableness to come into the law, you pay some price in certainty. The court has to find some reasonable balance between the need for certainty on the one hand and to have your law contract delivering results that ordinary sensible people and commercial people feel to be sensible and reasonable in the circumstances, where that you can't just act totally unfairly and unreasonably in your own interests without any regard to the interests of the other party to the contract.
And I think, sorry, but my last point, if I may, I do think that there will be a significant regard held to the identity of the parties. So if you have two very sophisticated financial institutions, two very sophisticated commercial entities, it's going to be much harder for one of them to set up where they had significant advice, legal advice, and that at the time the contract was entered into, for a party like that to assert ex post facto that it was unfair, and on enforcement as well. So I do think that one must contextualize these principles in the identity of the parties concerned, A, at the time of concluding the contract, and B, at the time of enforcing.
Well, certainly an eponymous decision. Gentlemen, thanks for the sage advice and the valuable contributions to this discussion, and certainly to creating certainty for the entire commercial sector. Thanks very much for the time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks
very much, Evan.
Thanks for listening to this first exciting episode of Business Law Focus. You can find our latest podcasts on Business Day, the Financial Mail, and the Business Live websites. If you like our podcasts, be sure to subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.